Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Milwaukee Opera Theater is known for doing a lot with very little. Little money, that is. The talent they showcase is large, and the way they showcase that talent belies their limited resources. From new works to inventive reimaginings of opera and operetta classics, an MOT show is guaranteed to not be boring while also being a deeply pleasurable artistic experience.
The company's reimagined The Magic Flute, yes, the one by Mozart, promises to be no exception to that rule. Sung and spoken in both German and English, with staging and performance help from Quasimondo Physical Theater and the Cadence Collective, this Magic Flute will take place in the round under the dome of the historic Tripoli Shrine. MOT's Jelena Ponasek and Quasimondo's Brian Rott direct, and company manager Danny Brilo translated the libretto. They join me in the studio now. Welcome to the show, and thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So another Milwaukee Opera Theater extravaganza, Jelena. I mean, it's like you keep topping yourself.
It's getting harder and harder.
I know.
It's a challenge.
We had to get a
Masonic temple for this one.
Yes. Which, of course, is perfect for the Magic Flute because Mozart was a Mason.
Yeah, so was Schikaneder, the librettist.
Was he really? Mm-hmm. Of course he was. They all were.
They all were. Yeah.
It was one of those things where everybody was that meant anyone at that time. Let's talk about what Masonry is, first of all, because that plays such an important part in the opera and also in the building that you're doing it in.
Thank you for starting with such an easy question, Bonnie. We'll just explain Freemasonry in 15 minutes on the radio.
Less.
Okay.
You have less.
We have less than 15 minutes. The opera embodies so many of the fraternal tenets of the Freemason movement and the period of the Enlightenment. It was written in 1791, and the themes of brotherhood, peace, justice, virtue, the triumph of good over evil are central to the storytelling. And then there's part in Act Two when our heroes and heroine undergo trials, which have some similarities to the initiation rituals in Masonic associations today.
Now, when Mozart and Schikaneder were writing this, their audience would have understood those rituals, right?
That's what people think. There's a lot of literature on this topic in particular, just how closely tethered is the Magic Flute to Freemasonry? Are there hidden symbols and hidden...
Which is so Freemasonry to do that.
Right.
To have all those hidden handshakes and
But without things. Doubt, so much of the imagery, so much of the fairy tale setting, and so many of the virtues that undergird the story are undoubtedly part of the fraternal movement even now.
And so, Danny, when you were translating this, is that something that you were thinking about as you were doing it, or were you approaching it in a different way?
Honestly, it was kind of like follow the plot as it is, which is very, I don't want to say convoluted, but very sort of Byzantine. I wasn't actually thinking about that aspect of it too much, to be honest, other than in the second act, you know, them going through the trials, the two heroes sort of going through the trials. Just sort of as an initiation ritual. But other than that, I was more interested in just kind of paring it down because we wanted it to be a little bit shorter production than the average kind of Magic Flute might be. And just, you know, cutting to the plot, basically, if that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah, as you say, it is very kind of labyrinthian. You know, there's a lot of different things going on.
So twisty-turny.
Yeah.
We thought a lot about contemporary values, about equality, about seeking truth, about achieving justice. And so those informed, I think, our translation quite a bit.
Yeah, that's true. And sort of along those lines, I was very okay with using, as you know, as you'll hear if you come to see the show, more contemporary language in parts, and then also kind of contrasting that with more sort of heightened, formalized, stylized language, particularly with Zarastro, since he's the sort of bearer of all these secrets of all these.
Well, the knowledge.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly.
The wisdom,
logic and reason.
He's the king, you know.
Right, so he, you know, sort of had this more, I don't want to even say like Shakespearean quality necessarily, but a more sort of heightened sense in the in the spoken dialogue, as opposed to, you know, Papageno probably on the other end of the spectrum, who is more of the, it's a comedy, but comic relief type character.
And more of the people, too, you know.
Yeah,
he's kind
exactly.
of like the everyman.
Or even just somebody who's, you know, purely driven by immediate gratification.
Yeah, I was going to say lust.
Right. Sometimes you just refer to him as the toddler, right. Masquerading kind of. As a grown man.
Yeah, the id.
The id. He's all id.
Yeah.
Lovable id.
Yes.
Boing. He just has poor impulse control. But other than that, he's a wonderful character.
And he's got some great arias.
He carries the show, man. Yeah. He sings so much. Papageno is really a massive role.
And you've got Nathan?
It's Nathan Weselowski, and it was the role that first made him want to become an opera singer, and it's the first time that he's playing it in a production. So, yeah, that's really fun to watch.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, because he's a tenor, and Papageno's a baritone, so he's never really had the opportunity, but because we're a little bit of a less traditional company, we said, hey, why not? Let's have Nathan do this baritone role. Because of all the reasons Jelena mentioned.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's going to be fun just to see that. But now, Brian, Quasimondo is part of this as well, and that's not the usual kind of pairing for the Magic Flute.
No.
And so how are you being, or your company, being included in all of this?
From the beginning, Jill and I meant to, you know, make this a real collaboration that brought different types of artists working together. You know, so I think that does make it a really unique presentation of the Magic Flute, and the fact that you have a balance between people that come from singing and more of an opera background, but then you also have members from our company that come and are bringing more of a background in, say, movement and performance acting. We also have a fair amount of puppetry within the production. I don't want to give anything away, but
there's a giant snake.
You gave it away.
She gave it away.
Well, we got a giant snake for one thing. Someone had one and let us use it.
Yeah.
But the Tamino, the very opening image of the opera is the Prince Tamino running from a snake or dragon, depending on how you translate the libretto, and it sort of symbolizes running from fears, running from responsibilities, and he has to confront those as he grows up in the opera.
Mm-hmm. And we wanted to highlight the magical quality of this production and the flute in general. And so I think through the use of object manipulation and a giant snake and a few other puppetry sequences, we're really helping to make something that is continually exciting and surprising.
I love the idea of adding the physical theater to this because it's the kind of opera that can take it.
Indeed.
It actually asks for it, I think.
Mm. I think so. It felt as we were searching for the kind of project to do, we ended up settling on the Magic Flute because of those specific themes. That it's so magical, it's so imaginative, it has the potential to sustain innovation. You know, it is such a strong structure to begin with and such stunning music. So we could have devised something original together, but we decided to adapt an existing work instead. And Brian and I had the opportunity to co-teach a undergraduate course at UW Parkside for the fall semester. So we had 7 undergraduate, very brave opera singing guinea pigs who kind of studied the score with us, studied the story, shared a whole bunch of their 19 and 20-year-old points of view with us. And we had that 3.5-month opportunity to just slowly move through the story and kind of ideate on what this piece could be. And then we have a cast of 12. We have reduced it to a cast of 12, 6 of whom are experienced opera singers and 6 have never been in an opera before. So,
yeah.
Wow, that's brave.
Uh-huh. They are such incredible troopers, and it's so inspiring to watch them go for it and to watch the singers appreciating their work and also taking inspiration from that. We had the beautiful rehearsal moment when the singer playing Pamina cried watching 2 of the dancers just dance through a piece that she's obviously very, very familiar with. She's studied it for years. But the fact that these dancers were improvising to it kind of tapped into something else and made it moving in a new way for her. So that was, really thrilling. It's like just completely addictive to watch artists inspiring each other.
You mentioned Zarastro, and of course, as a main kind of linchpin of this whole thing. And Mark Corkins is playing your Zarastro, and he's not singing.
Yeah, he's not a singer.
Right. And he's not attempting to sing, right?
No, he's not. No, he's singing in the chorus. He is doing some singing, but he did write in our Butter third email exchange. He said, I'm very interested in this project, but I would just like to confirm at this point that there is no solo singing required.
Well, particularly if he's not a basso Because Zarastro has
indeed
that intense, deep, almost basso profundo.
So to explore the dichotomy between the Queen of the Night and Zarastro, our queen is an opera singer named Sarah Richardson, who has done the role many times, and she's singing in original language as written. And then to kind of play the extreme alternate to that, we cast an established actor as Zarastro. So his decorum and the musicality of his speaking voice is so majestic. It's just like it is as beautiful as the singing voices. It's just a different way of using the human voice. So he is just as strong a companion for her, but he is not singing. He speaks over underscoring. So we've given some of Zarastro's music, his melodic lines, to the cello. And then in the instance of his very famous aria, O Isi Sendo Siris, Paula Tillin, our music director, did an arrangement of it for two sopranos and two altos. So it is still in the opera, but it's a choral arrangement instead of a solo for bass.
And so, Danny, were you also translating arias and that as well, not just the libretto?
Yeah, that's right. So I did most of the musical numbers as well as the spoken dialogue. We decided to keep a couple numbers in German, just to kind of vary it up a little bit, basically.
Part of anchoring it in the past and acknowledging where we're coming from. Like, we're still tethered to 1791 and what Mozart and Schikaneder created together. But then we're kind of yanking it into our age as well. So the queen, she's the most closely tied to that original source. And then we stretch all the way to today.
Well, and talk about, you mentioned the cello. How many musicians?
That's a great question. So we're also collaborating with Cadence Collective, which is a trio, Alicia Storin, the cellist, Emma Coy, flautist and dancer, and then Crystal Wagner, dancer and now opera singer. So they themselves are an ensemble, and they do improvised and devised pieces together. And we invited all three of them to be part of this production. So Crystal is singing and roller skating and dancing the role of Papagena.
I love it.
Yeah. She skated for about 12 years of her childhood. So she's strapping on her racing skates and skates while singing the duet. And Emma studied both dance and flute academically and formed the ensemble because she wanted to be able to express the dancer part of herself and was looking for a way to an outlet to do that. And so this project was an opportunity for her to do both. So there are times when she sets down her flute and moves with us, and there are times when she moves while playing the flute with us.
I was going to ask if there was flute playing in motion.
Yeah.
And there is.
And there's cello playing in motion. Alicia has a strap that allows her to stand and play certain sounds while moving.
Very cool.
So the only instrument we don't move around is the piano.
Do people dance around the piano, though?
Yes, everything happens around the piano.
Yes, okay.
The pit is kind of the centerpiece of our set, really. And so the music and the ensemble is there at the forefront the entire show. We're also performing in the round, which is, I think, a very interesting way of staging the magic flute, particularly tailored to the Tripoli Shrine Center, right underneath the big dome of the building. So,
well, I was going to say, put it in the round just for the added extra challenge.
Yeah, it's in the round and it's on two stories.
Oh.
So we're actually doing sort of, I don't know what that's called in theater, the double round, I don't know. We're inventing a new
round
configuration.
Yeah, the double round. I like the double
because
round.
Because the singers are using the balcony as well.
So there's some antiphonal things going on. Oh, my goodness.
There's a lot of clockwise and counterclockwise movement. It's exciting. It's immersive in an interesting way. I mean, the audience is still, they're seated in a radiating circles right in the dome, you know, so they're all pointed toward the center of the dome, which is such a stunning piece of architecture and Milwaukee history.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they look up, they'll see the singers in the balcony.
The Magic Flute is directed by Milwaukee Opera Theater's Jill Anna Ponisic and Quasimondo Physical Theater's Brian Rott. Danny Brilo translated the libretto. The show opens at the Triple I Shrine Friday evening and runs 2 weekends. There's more information at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next, and it's 11 o'clock.